I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and today we're going to Edinburgh in Scotland. Once a medieval powerhouse sitting on a lava flow, it sprouted into Europe's first great grid-planned modern city. It's the colorful hometown of Robert Louis Stevenson, Sir Walter Scott, and Robert Burns, and it's Scotland's showpiece in one of Europe's most entertaining cities. Historic, monumental, fun, and well-organized, it's a tourist delight, especially in August when the Edinburgh Festival takes over the town. And I've got with me two guides that are joining me from Edinburgh. They're here in the studio, Ken Hanley and Anne Doig. And we're going to visit a city that really is the historical and cultural capital of Scotland. Thank you so much for coming to our studio today.
Pleasure.
Pleasure. Thanks for having us.
You're both hometown people there. What little nutshell advice can you give Americans visiting Edinburgh to most enjoy your beautiful city?
Well, I think it's a very good city to walk around. So to start off with Edinburgh Castle, that's an impressive view of the whole city, and then work your way down the Royal Mile, and you really can feel and touch and taste it that way.
So that really is quintessential Edinburgh there.
Starting with the castle and doing the Royal Mile and the old little closes and alleyways. There's museums there, there's shops, and the Museum of Scotland's not far off the Royal Mile, and it's an excellent introduction to the country. The whole of Scotland's culture is there, from the Romans right up to through industry and empire and right up to the present day.
And this mile has got to be one of the most historic miles anywhere, conveniently downhill from the castle to the palace. And now this museum you're talking about really makes it a wonderful education. What, a couple blocks off, you've got, what's the museum called?
The National Museum of Scotland. It's an absolute jewel in the crown, Rick. It truly is. And you would expect Anne and I to say that. But in actual fact, it transports you through 2,000 years of Scottish history, unashamedly. So I would say that's another must visit. And as Anne rightly says, you encapsulate 2,000 years of history. You physically view a medieval old town, a purpose-built Georgian Victorian new towns, and you see peripheral to that 21st century Edinburgh, which in anybody's book is just mind-blowing. So for anybody coming from America, as Anne said, the castle, Royal Mile, that's a great starting point. And then you roll from there to the museums and so on.
And that National Museum, there's a lot of museums. This is new. If you have a five-year-old guidebook, I don't think you'd have the information in it.
Absolutely not.
It's called the National Museum.
And it really is all about the Kingdom of the Scots.
And it's got artifacts. You know, you go to a lot of museums and it's like reading a book standing up. They just blow up the pages and the photographs and they put them on the wall and charge you admission. And I go, what's going on here? But here we have real artifacts. There's a fan celebrating a victory of Bonnie Prince Charlie with Bonnie Prince Charlie and his cohorts on the fan, so the aristocratic women could have this as an accessory when they go to the victory party.
Victory party, absolutely. It's just one of these completely unique. And you know what? Entrance is free as well, Rick.
There's
no charge for that or any of the galleries in the city or in Glasgow or Aberdeen around the country.
But now, these are free. Is that an initiative of the government, and will that change if the government changes?
No, I think, nothing's cast in stone, I don't think, Anne, but I think that the long-term policy is that entrance to all these museums and galleries are free unless we have a special.
Right, sure.
Something like that.
But I know in some countries it's actually free as long as this party's in power and a new government comes in and they'll change that. But I think in Britain, generally, some of the accommodations and the meals and the drinks are expensive, but the museums, generally free, the National Museums.
It's actually the city councils that run the museums. And it is a debatable point, because in Glasgow, they have hundreds of people going to their museums and galleries there, and they cost a lot of money for the city to run. And they often, it does come onto the table, should we charge? But I don't think they ever will.
Now, you two are taking groups through Edinburgh day after day. What is, for you, the biggest joy in your work of showing off your city with these foreign guests?
I think one of the things that both Anne and I infuse about is that we've been guides, as you rightly say, for a long time. And for us, it's almost like the first time every time, because Edinburgh has this Pandora's box and you can open it on Monday and get something terribly special for us. So when we infuse like that about the little things, now I'm not going to mention the castle or the palace or anything like that. Go in and out the closes and you observe the history. You feel history. You walk history. It's excitement all the way for us. And I think that in a way we generate that to the people. And when that goes across, people go away infused. Take our new parliament, for instance. to local Scots, it's an abomination, it's an expense that we didn't have to have, and yet it won the architectural award for the new build in the world. And yet there we are, typical Scots, calling it this abomination. And yet,
costs too much money, you see. Scots don't like to spend money.
So you have this striking new Parliament building that really is quite a statement about Scottish pride. You mentioned earlier going into the close. Now, so we have to remind our listeners, Edinburgh was the most densely populated city in its heyday in the Middle Ages. And you walk down these, the buildings got taller and taller. They say the first skyscrapers in Europe were in Edinburgh. Yep. And then what is a close? Take me into a close so people know what this
is. Well, in the old days, a close would be something that had a gate, whether it be wooden, whether it be metal, and it would lead you into a courtyard. Hence the name, a close, so that you had the power, you had the wherewithal to close that gate or into the courtyard. Or you might have a wind, W-Y-N-D, and that's something, that stairs that take you turnpike, round like that.
Spiralling.
So, spiralling, a wind. So you can have a wind or a close. In old Scots, Anne and I might call it an entry.
So there's a lot of jargon you need to know to understand a map when you're around in Edinburgh, when you're getting directions from locals.
Close is really just another name for a lane or alleyway now leading into the buildings at the back. And they were closed off, so hence it became an enclosure, hence the name Close.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. And today we're in Edinburgh. And do I get the pronunciation right there?
Yeah.
Say it for me in your good
Edinburgh.
Note. Edinburgh.
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 Edinburgh. Roll that R.
Edinburgh. It's like B-U-R-R-E.
Say it for me again.
Edinburgh.
And Ken?
I would do the other way and say to you, in America, I would say Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh. Edinburgh.
Okay. Edinburgh.
So, but to say Edinburgh, like Pittsburgh.
No. Wrong. You're a stranger.
Then you're
you
a stranger.
Stand out. You've got Edinburgh. A stamp on the head. You're
Edinburgh.
A stranger.
All right. I've got Ken Hanley and Anne Doig from Edinburgh. Thanks for joining me. And we're talking about the wonders of the historic and political capital of Scotland. You could call Edinburgh the historic, artistic, religious, and political capital of Scotland.
Yes.
Is that true? Glaswegians, Glasgow people would be okay with that?
They don't like that at all.
They don't like it.
But could they make a case that they're the capital?
No.
If you're from Glasgow, how would you call York City the capital of Scotland? In what way?
I think Glasgow claims, and rightly so, on the industrial tag.
So it's the industrial...
It was the second city of the empire. But you know what?
So it's the rust capital of Scotland.
But yes. It's also the cultural capital. Although from Edinburgh, I have to support Glasgow in this because it's the home of the Scottish Opera, Scottish television.
Okay, culture in Glasgow.
Culture, yeah. Royal Scottish Academy. It's got the best design school.
Art Nouveau,
yes. City of Architecture and Design.
Charlie McIntosh. Charles Rennie McIntosh.
Yeah?
Yes.
Now, a lot of people go in their travels to the touristic superstars and they forget the place that the real heartbeat is of a country's economy and so on. Could you make a case that Glasgow is a good side trip from Edinburgh or a worthwhile place to visit on a short trip?
Absolutely. And I mean, the trains run only,
Every
15 minutes.
And how long would it take to get to Glasgow?
An hour.
So within an hour, you could be from Edinburgh to Glasgow. If you got 4 days in Edinburgh, maybe you could make the case that 3 days in Edinburgh and 1 day in Glasgow would be a good idea.
Without doubt, you have the first museum of religion in the world in Glasgow.
All right.
You have the Burrell Collection. You have the House for an Art Lover.
People talk like Andy Capp there, don't they?
Yes, they talk.
Well, they have a... Well,
or is that his name, the cartoon guy?
Cartoon guy, aye. No, you're thinking of Billy Connolly, possibly. But Andy Capp is a cartoon character as well.
Does he have a Scottish...
Absolutely. But it's a broad accent. In Glasgow, it would be... Goonie no go there, Rick. I just no gonna do that, son.
Wisney me.
It wisney me. It was her.
What's wisney me, Anne? What is that?
It means it wasn't me.
Wisney me.
It wisney me.
So there's a language barrier for the American in Glasgow.
Is there
a language barrier for the Edinburgh person in Glasgow?
I think
maybe
so.
Maybe not.
More for the American, I think.
Yeah.
Hey, we have some callers on the line. Let's talk to Terry in Cincinnati. Hi, Terry. Thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick.
Yeah.
Nice talking to you. Love your show.
Oh, thanks. You got some questions about Edinburgh or some comments?
Yes. We would like to take a family vacation there for a week in all of Scotland and are looking into like renting a house. There's 7 adults and 1 baby and want to know if this is feasible, if it's a good idea, or if it would be better to stay like 3 days in Edinburgh and then go out to the high country. You know, so we want to know if we have enough to do for like day trips from one location.
Well, how would you, Anne and Ken, advise a gang of eight to have a good look at Scotland?
You can do both, to be honest. Hi, Terry, it's Ken here. Anne will have a word with you in a moment. But you can do both. You could base yourself in Edinburgh. And I say that because you want to maximise what you can do. And Edinburgh does offer you an enormous amount of things to do on a daily basis. But you could also split it as well, and you could stay in Edinburgh and possibly stay in Inverness. My personal preference for you with a family that size would be to stay in Edinburgh for the duration of your holiday and enjoy the city and then start to stretch your legs by going to St Andrews, the Trossachs, a day trip to Glasgow and a day trip in the Borders. And what you'll find is your week will very quickly disappear, but having stayed in the one area, you'll absorb the culture, you'll absorb the history, and it'll want you to come back and explore the Highlands and Islands. So that would be my suggestion.
Yes, I would agree with that. But I think I would also say that if I were you, I would want to go up to Inverness or further north, because it's quite a drive from Edinburgh up to the Highlands. So yeah, you can do definitely 3 or 4 days in Edinburgh, but then another 3 basing yourself in Inverness so that you can see the Highlands that are truly beautiful, and even maybe go to the Island of Skye. And then you wouldn't be spending so much time coming back to Edinburgh. So I would recommend a split between Edinburgh and Inverness.
Yeah, I think with a family of 8, you would find the efficiency of being set up in a big city with so many sites per square acre really convenient and efficient, and you'd want to stay in Edinburgh for a good 3 or 4 days. With 8 people, you'd be very well off with a minibus, and they're quite inexpensive to rent and easy to rent, and you can do it even a open jaws approach where you picked it up in one city and dropped it in another from a big company. There's a good road up to Inverness from Edinburgh, and there you could make a loop and explore some of the wild Highlands, and that might give you the most travel thrills. Terry, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We're focusing on Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland. It was once the most crowded city in Europe, famed for its skyscrapers and its filth. The rich and the poor lived virtually atop one another. And in the Age of Enlightenment, a magnificent new Georgian city, that's today's Newtown, was laid out just across what was the lake. They drained the lake. They have the old town. Then what was the lake is now the administrative center with great museums and train station and shopping center and tourist information office. And on the other side, we've got Georgian Edinburgh with a grid plan and a brand new futuristic looking town that came out of the Age of Enlightenment. It's a magnificent city, the artistic and historic and political capital of Scotland. And today they've got a new parliament building that puts a spring in the steps of the people in Edinburgh. And Ken and Anne, thanks for joining us. We're learning about your great city.
Thanks for asking us.
My little thumbnail there of Edinburgh. I hope that was okay. What an exciting time to be in Edinburgh.
It is indeed, yes. And it was an excellent introduction to Edinburgh. Yes.
Well, to me, it's fun to see a town that has so much history, like in that Royal Mile, the most exciting downhill one-mile walk, I think, you could make a case in anywhere in Britain, starting at the castle, going all the way to the palace. And then you cross over the what was the lake, and you've got this beautiful, in the couple hundred years ago, modern grid-planned city with all this Georgian elegance. And when we say Georgian in Britain, we're really talking neoclassical.
Yeah.
Under the King George's, you know, and that was the style of the age when the colonies on this side of the Atlantic were breaking away. We're all building and excited about this neoclassical architecture in Britain. You'll see that word Georgian. Thanks for joining us. And we've got people calling us with questions about Edinburgh. I'd like to talk with John in Olney, Maryland. Hi, John.
Hey, Rick, how are you today?
Great. Thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you. My daughter and I visited Edinburgh last spring, just had an absolutely wonderful time. Loved walking the Royal Mile and the area downtown there. And we are liked it so much, we're going back. And one of the things that we kind of missed last year, the experience, was the opportunity to experience some live music in Edinburgh. And I was just wondering if there's any venues or what are some of the opportunities for that we might find that's appropriate, maybe outside of pubs.
That's a good distinction there. So outside of pubs, you got your daughter with you, and you want to get a good dose of traditional music.
Right.
One of the places that you might like to try when you go back is a place called The Hub. You might have noticed that on your travels up to the castle, because there is an information centre, and they'll give you all the information about Celtic music, Scottish music, Cayleys, and all of that. For by that, you have the local TIC, Tourist Information Centre, which is situated on Princes Street, just next to the railway station there. Or you might like to try George IV Bridge, Victoria Street, and even the Grass Market. What do you think, Anne?
Yes, I agree with that. The traditional music, there is a Celtic festival, but it's in Glasgow in January, so that might be out of season. And that's one of the best times if you're really interested in traditional music. In Edinburgh, a lot of it's focusing on the pubs. Out with the pubs, you'd really have to find out what the planned programmes were for some of the venues, and that would be going to the hub.
Now, we should remind John that the pubs in Europe or in Britain are different than bars in America. And, you know, you'd be comfortable taking your daughter in there. Is that a concern of yours? How old's your daughter?
Well, she's 16. And we certainly spent a little time in the pubs last year and trying it's fine. But I was thinking maybe if some of the music was like a later time or whatever in the evening, then it might not be appropriate.
Isn't there a publication called The Good Gig Guide or something like that?
The Gig Guide,
yes. The
Gig Guide is a little freebie that any pub that's interested in music contributes to and distributes, I believe, and you can get it at the tourist office or at participating pubs. Also, I'm frustrated in Edinburgh because I really want to see a folk show, and I want the dancing, I want the pipes, I want any, it's kind of clichetic touristic stuff, but it's also a real part of the culture. And they're getting so cheesy, and, you know, it's just a, they've sold out, as far as I've discovered, on the traditional classic Scottish
they
folk shows.
They don't do it well at all. No,
there's just no place
like
to go.
Variety. That's
and
true.
It's a variety show with an electric organ and a guy with a kilt.
You definitely want to avoid that.
Well, you do. You definitely do want to avoid that, John.
Celtic Connections is the best thing in January.
Yeah.
What about hotel shows, the Caledonian or something?
One or two of the hotels do, but again, it goes along that chintzy cheesy line.
The North Sea Gas. Do you remember that group?
North Sea Gas, yes. First class, and you get North Sea Gas. And I was about to say that. There's a place in Blackfriars Street in Edinburgh. And also, there's another one you might like to check out, John, on the top of Holyrood Road. It's called the Holyrood Inn. And they do spontaneous gigs where people come in and just break into a sort of semi-jamming session. And I would look that one up as well, the Holyrood Inn on Holyrood Road.
Hey, John, my favorite band, and I'm not that into it, but 20 years ago, I enjoyed the North Sea Gas, and they've kind of gone out of the pubs and into more of stage shows now, I think, and they're really good. If you can get to town, ask about the North Sea Gas. I would say wherever they're performing, go there, and you're in for a great show.
For sure.
We were interested in Salsa Celtica.
Salsa Celtica?
Celtica.
Salsa?
Celtica, yeah.
Did you say salsa?
Yes.
As a dancing?
Is that? I've never heard of that.
I haven't heard of that either, no.
Oh, no, it's apparently, from what I read on, they're a local Edinburgh band, but they studied in Havana, and they play a kind of an interesting blend of Celtic and Cuban music.
Wow.
The problem with them, John, is that they're out of town a lot. There is another band on that theme, and their name is called the Red Hot Chili Pipers.
Red Hot Chili Pipers. That's good.
There's another one called Macumba. It's African drums and the pipes.
Yeah. As Anne says, Macumba as well. So, one or two suggestions for you, but enjoy.
Well, bottom line on this traditional music, unfortunately, I've talked to a lot of guys who run pubs that used to be famous for traditional music. They make more money selling more beer to people who don't like traditional music. They just want modern
progressive rock.
So if you're interested in making money in a characteristic old pub in Edinburgh, you're not going to cater to a few tourists and their daughters. You're going to be catering to the footballers and the local guys that want to go out and have some progressive rock. So go to the tourist office and get whatever's going on locally. And good luck. Thanks for your call, John.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And Jim is on the line in Decorah, Iowa. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Well, we were fortunate enough to visit Edinburgh last year. Our son is doing graduate work at the University of Edinburgh, and we're hoping to go back again. We feel like we walked the whole city last year and fell in love with it. We've got an idea of what's on the surface, but we've been intrigued by the underground ghost tours. Are those anything we should try for?
My name's Ken, and I'll hand you over to Anne in a moment because I think you're going to get two different answers here.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that you probably could well enjoy the underground. My particular favourite is Mary King's Close because that does tell the story about an absolute happening underground where the closes were sealed off because of the plague. You actually physically get to see how people lived and the circumstances they lived in them.
I'm sorry, that was Mary King?
Mary King's Close.
So Mary King's Close.
Would be a definite for me for visiting. The other tours, some of them are a bit cheesy, some of them are a bit chintzy. And so on, but they do add to a lot of flavour in the old town. But for me personally, Mary King's Close, and I'll hand you over to Anne.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, no, I think I probably agree with you. Hello, this is Anne here. Yes, Mary King's Close is a very good visit. The ghost tours, it depends on your guide. Sometimes they're very entertaining, but it's a bit uneven. I always find it very hard to recommend a particular company. I used to recommend this company, Witchery Tours, and I went on one in August, and it wasn't very good at all. It was terrible. So there's Auld Reekie Tours. They're very popular, and all down the Royal Mile, if you've been there before, you'll see they've got their boards up and they've got comments from in the press about them. So I would look at that and see which one suits you, because there's quite a variety. But Mary King's Close is just right opposite St Giles, right under the City Chambers. And I agree with Ken, that's definitely worth a visit.
You know, Jim, when you're thinking about the walks, I would consider the ghost walks kind of a lowbrow entertainment if you don't want to go to a movie or a pub in the evening. Take a night walk, but don't expect any real history. Unfortunately for all of us guides, the big sellers are the Jack the Ripper tours and then ghost walks and so on. And every town's got a ghost walk in Britain. I would say the towns with the greatest heritage of ghosts and witch burnings are York and Edinburgh. If you're going to do a ghost tour, do it in York and Edinburgh. Don't expect heavy history, and don't do it at the expense of a real walk with a real guide like Anne or Ken during the day. They offer these tours beautifully on the Royal Mile. You see the people with their little signposts and so on. It's very inexpensive. It's wonderful fun. You get to know other tourists. You get real history during the daytime walks. At night, it's just kind of haunted house gore and cheesy fun. I mean, they've got these things called screamers, don't they? And they work with the jumpers. Jumpers, and you're in the middle of this. You're in this big tunnel, and a jumper comes out at you, and it's kind of fun. I remember a line that said, it was so poor and so dark and so crowded. The people couldn't even afford candles, and they knew each other by how they smelled.
That's true.
It's true. All right. Jim, good luck on your ghost tours.
Thank you very much for your help.
All right.
Bye, Jim.
Bye.
Bye.
Olga in Vancouver, thanks for your call.
Rick, my husband and I have really enjoyed all your travel shows and your radio shows.
Thank you.
And we were in Edinburgh last summer with our 6-year-old and 10-year-old. And we really enjoyed the city, but we also enjoyed day trips out to Stirling Castle and going out to the lochs.
To the lochs? The lakes?
Yes.
Is that what the lochs are, the lakes?
Lochs, yeah.
Yeah, you've got to understand, Olga, you're in a civilized country and we call them lochs.
But if we say lake, you can understand us.
Well, yeah. A lake is
you'll
a
You'll correct
loch.
Us. You'll be polite,
say
I hope.
With a sound.
All right.
And one other thing I was going to mention was that our family got to go to the Perth Highland Games during August, and it was just wonderful because it gave you that down-home feel.
All right.
Very good.
Yeah. Olga, let me ask you a question. What was it about Stirling Castle that you liked? That's the because there's two big castles. There's one in Edinburgh, and then about an hour away, you've got one in the town of Stirling. Why did you like the Stirling Castle?
I liked the guide that we had. He was an elderly gentleman, and he just really focused on our children and telling them all the history. And it just felt like a very special tour, and we just had a great time learning about the castle.
I think it's fair to say that the guides you're going to encounter in these great historic sites of Scotland take a certain joy out of getting the kids enthusiastic about the history.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Ken and I've always debated in my mind Stirling Castle or Edinburgh Castle. Mm-hmm. If you have limited time, should you do both? Or if you've done the Edinburgh Castle, does that mean Stirling is a little less important?
I probably would do both, to be honest, because they're representative of eras in our history that are so strong. For instance, Stirling Castle, we hang, you know, the movie Braveheart. But by that, you know, there is so much because the topography dictates that it was very important to have control. So for that standpoint, yeah, it's a castle. A castle's a castle. And then from the historical royalty field as well, then Edinburgh with the crown jewels, the Stone of Destiny and that. So if possible, I would do both.
So they're distinct. They're different.
I would say so.
Ma'am? Yeah.
Yes, yes. It depends on your itinerary, really. Mm. If you've visited a lot of castles, I would just say do one.
And if you had to choose one, Anne, which
I would probably
choose
Edinburgh. But maybe that's because I live in Edinburgh.
Yeah. Edinburgh is so many faceted. And it's so well presented, and it's so convenient. It's right there at the top of the hill in the town, you know.
The one thing you don't want to do, Olga, is what we call in the industry as the ABC tour.
Another Blooming Castle.
Another Blooming Castle. I like that. Hey, Olga, you did the Highland Games in Perth.
Yes.
There's a lot of different... is that the games, or how did you choose that? And what,
I was looking on the internet for Highland Games, and I came across... just like little community ones. So like the winners from these little community games go on to the big ones. And so they had the dancing, the pipers. They even had foot races, and our kids were allowed to go and join in the foot races.
Yeah, now that's the beauty of going to the charming little village games, I think, because if you went to the big games, they'd have ropes for the tourists to stand behind, and they'd have all sorts of formalities. I got to throw the caber, big, that was like a telephone pole. They tried to, I almost got a hernia throwing that thing, but I think I was the most entertaining person there in the event, the way I was clowning around with that. But it's because we stumbled into a little town, I don't even know the name, for a clan gathering. Anne and Ken, what's some advice for an American visiting Scotland wanting to get a charming small clan gathering? Or would you recommend going to the big famous ones?
It depends on where you're staying, but there is a list. If you go on the website, the Scottish Tourist Board, or Visit Scotland, as it's called nowadays, have a whole list of the games. The most famous is the Braemar Gathering, because the Queen attends. But the smaller ones are they're always very entertaining if you can get involved.
And I would tend to go for the smaller ones, in particular with your experience at Perth. I would look out for the ones, for instance, in the Trossachs or, you know, Loch Lomond side, you know, the small ones. And you can get that, as Anne said, from Visit Scotland. There is a list of all the Highland games. Go for the smaller ones, and who knows, you might win the competition of tossing the caber or throwing the haggis or something like that.
Great dancing, too, to see the little girls dancing.
Isn't it wonderful?
And the local bagpipe band, it's just like the high school marching band here. It's just a lot of traditional culture for the local people, not on stage for the tourists. Is there a season for these Highland? When is the season?
It's the end of June through to the beginning of September, really, about the beginning to middle of September.
So it's through the summer season.
Through the summer months.
And I would advise our listeners, if a lot of people say go shoulder season, you'll miss the heat and the crowds. I don't think you got crowd and heat problems in Scotland as much as weather concerns. And I love going in the middle of the summer as much as possible when you got long days and plenty of activities.
That's right.
Are you guys okay with that? Uh-huh. Now, you said the Visit Scotland is the new name of the Tourist Information Centre.
Yeah.
I find it quite a money-grubbing for-profit business now that is in the employ of big tourist businesses, big hotels, big tour companies, and so on. What frustrations do you have with what was the Tourist Information Centre and is now more of a sales agency, or am I just being too cynical?
I think you're absolutely right in what you say, but since we both come from Scotland and we have to try and promote and help the national agency, but what you say, I think probably both Anne and I do agree with you, but having said that, they are good for information, and information can be gleaned for visits to enhance a visit.
A good website, but just as a consumer, be aware that...
Yeah.
It's not an information rack. It's a rack of brochures that people paid to have their advertising displayed on, I think. And there's a lot of good little businesses that don't play by the rules, and they don't get the front row exposure from a lot of people think is an information service.
Yeah.
But it's the only game on the street, so you got to go there to get information, but you need to be a savvy consumer when sorting through that information.
I think also for Olga, and I know it's not our main reason just for going for Highland Games, but keep that tradition going, Olga, because it's the heart and soul of our country. It's our traditions from birth. It's what our whole culture, our whole Celtic being is about.
Oh, I really enjoyed going there, and I know our whole family wants to go back there again.
Yeah. All right. Hey, Olga, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And we got James on the line from Plano, Texas. Hi, James.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Great. Thanks for your call.
Listen, we went to Scotland about 18 months ago, and I got converted to Scotch.
Good for you.
I really enjoy the water of life over there. So I noticed that there was a tour from like the Whiskey Distillers Company on the High Street, and we didn't get to it, and I just wondered if it would be worthwhile.
Do you mean the tour of the Scotch Whiskey Heritage Centre? Is that what you're talking about?
Up by the castle.
Up by the castle. Yeah. That's I would say that's a kind of visit if you can't get to a genuine distillery and you're interested in whiskey. Yes, visit it by all means. But it's a bit touristy. If you can get to a proper distillery, and there are hundreds of them, that would be my suggestion. There's one very near Edinburgh called Glenkinchie. And of course, there's lots up in Speyside, up in the Highlands. So that would be what I would suggest that you did. And you can get to the real distilleries. There are organised tours. They're a little bit difficult to get to if you're going on public transport, like by bus or train, but there are tours that take you to the distilleries. So I would recommend the real distillery.
As opposed to what we like to call Malt Disney.
Yes, Malt Disney.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I would 100% agree with Anne. The other thing is that there are one or two wonderful shops, and down the Royal Mile, there's a shop called the Cadden Heads. And if you were to pop in there, these guys know their product. They eat, sleep and breathe it, as do I myself and Anne. But, and sometimes Rick as well, you know. But they tell you about the real whiskies. That's my point. They tell you about the unchilled, unfiltered. And if you're a man that likes your whiskies, Anne suggested to you, up in the Highlands and so on, and in the shops, you'll be in Seventh Heaven. And have a look at the Malt Whiskey Society as well, which is in Queen Street in Edinburgh or in Leith. And it's in a building where they've stored spirits from Europe since about the 13th century, and called the Leith Claret. So if you're a whiskey man and it's a big part for your trip, this is good information for you.
And even if you're not a whiskey man, I have never understood whiskey until last year, and Ken brought me into Cadden Heads. That's the little whiskey shop at the bottom of the Royal Mile, and the man there is just so passionate and evangelical about the wonders of whiskey in the rough. Yeah. And my biggest regret is I finished that bottle. I got to go back to Edinburgh. I mean, just for the good whiskey from Cadden Heads. Now, what about, and I guess a point Anne made, which is really good, if you're going to be out in the countryside, don't waste time with a touristy distillery tour in Edinburgh when you can really go to a on-the-site distillery tour in a small town. I think Oban is an obvious check.
Yeah,
everybody goes to Oban, and there's a
good distillery there.
There, right into downtown.
Andrew Dower.
Here's an interesting idea, though. There's pubs all over the place, and pubs are not just the appreciation of beer.
Yeah,
there's a great whiskey
culture. That's
where
we got our flavor from the first time with the pub. So yeah. I'm real excited about it. I'm like you, though, Rick. I need to get back over there to get the bottle of Scotland that I like.
All right, James, thanks for your call. Have a good time next time over there.
Slange, James.
And we got Jamie in Battleground. Jamie, what's on your mind?
Actually, I have a question for our guides. I took up wearing kilts a number of years ago. In fact, at this point, I no longer own a pair of long pants.
Good man.
When I was in Edinburgh, between Christmas and Hogmanay a couple of years ago, I was the only person in a kilt. I'm in all kinds of people's photo albums because they assumed that I was a local. Now, the next time I go, I plan on going a little bit later in the season. And I have heard that if you're in Scotland, particularly in Edinburgh, wearing a kilt, you're probably a tourist. And I would hate to have any of the locals think that I was trying to be a poser or something.
Oh, absolutely not. One, I'm awful proud of you. You're my boy. Welcome to the club, my man. And you keep wearing that kilt, let me tell you. I wear a kilt every day. And friends say to me, they didn't ken me without pants on.
Wait a sec, they said what to you?
They don't know him without pants on.
Well, I've done that in Scots.
Say that again in Scots.
Well, they didn't ken me with my breeks on. But let me be, I am terribly proud that you should want to wear a kilt and don't feel that you're treated as a tourist. You most definitely would not be. And I take my hat off to you. Keep wearing the kilt, my man, and welcome to the club.
We were talking, this is Anne here, what's on my thoughts is it's not just tourists that wear kilts in Scotland. It may be when you went at a very busy time that everyone you saw on the streets were tourists and they weren't wearing the kilt. And the people wearing the kilt were at balls or dances or parties inside their own homes and things, because that's when they wear the kilt. So,
all right. So you're not seen as an eccentric
wearing a kilt
on the streets of Edinburgh.
Yeah. Never use the word poser for you wearing a kilt. I'll tell you what, the kilt is the only garment that we have as a national costume, the Scots, and it can be worn on high days and holidays. It crosses all social divides. So it is
democratic
an incredible democratic And you ain't nothing. You're definitely not a poser, my man. You join the club and join the clan. Well done to you.
Well, thank you. I'm not too concerned about being an eccentric here at home. Everybody thinks I already am, but like I said, I would certainly not want anybody to misunderstand why I was wearing the kilt when I was there.
No, we're terribly proud that you'd want to do that, believe me.
Well, thank you.
Jamie, thanks so much for your call.
You're welcome.
And you're not a poser.
Good.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm Rick Steves, and today we're enjoying Edinburgh. I've got two great guides with me, Ken Hanley and Anne Doig. I've worked with them in Edinburgh, and today they're in our studios sharing an insight into their great city. And we've got some emails. David in Tacoma emails us and asks, what are the dates of the Edinburgh tattoo, and how far out of the city does one have to go to get budget accommodations? He just loves the bagpipes. First of all, what is the tattoo?
Tattoos are a military extravaganza, in actual fact. It's a feast of bagpiping and marching and that. It actually comes from the Belgian of turning the taps. So the soldiers would be calmed down at the end of the day by giving a beer, and it's turning the taps off. That's what it means, tattoo, physically, to turn off the taps.
And it's sort of the massing of the bands now, isn't it? Military
pipes.
Bands.
In the old days, it would have been a single piper beating the retreat and calming the troops or the clans down. So we've brought it into a modern idiom, and it's usually in August. It runs 3 weeks in the month of August.
It's a huge, colourful festival of bagpipes, and it takes place every night in the esplanade of the castle.
Is it tough to get tickets for a tourist?
It is, and if you go on the internet just now, you'll find that it's sold out. But don't let that deter you. Tickets can be had and bought at the ticket office in Market Street in Edinburgh.
And you know, for me, one of the great cultural experiences is to watch the tattoo on TV with local people, because isn't it the opening night of the tattoo or something's a big deal all around Britain? Do they air it? Is it a tradition?
Yeah, they actually televise it into about maybe the middle of the second week, but it airs nationally on television. And it is, as you say, Rick, it's a big deal.
And do you think the tattoo's worth the trouble for tourists?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it's the sort of star attraction. It's become the biggest event of the festival seasons. Edinburgh has really almost become the city of festivals in Europe, particularly in August. There's the official festival, the Fringe Festival, the Jazz and Blues Festival, the Book Festival, the Film Festival.
Overlapping at the same
all
time.
All overlapping. Yeah. The tattoo kicks it off. It
well,
starts.
That gets back to David's questions. What about accommodations? To me, in my experience, everything is easy. There's almost as much entertainment as there are audience. You know, I mean, you can get tickets to a lot of things, but getting a room, I would just imagine you need to book it long in advance and be ready to pay a ransom.
Absolutely. I think years in advance wouldn't be, you know, understating it.
And it's reasonable for a B&B to jack up their price during the festival because there's going to be a huge demand.
Yeah. What they say is that at the other times of the year, that's an off-peak price, and in August, this is the normal price.
Oh, yeah.
That's the way they get away with it.
But all over Europe, they do that.
But you could travel in from Glasgow, actually, because it's just a 15-minute.
Good idea.
50-minute. Actually, the whole of the central belt of Scotland, the tattoo people say, are taken up by people staying for the tattoos. So.
Okay. And Edinburgh is a transportation hub, therefore side-tripping in to the festival is reasonable.
Possible, yeah.
For me, the most stirring and emotional moment is, I think it's the finale of the tattoo, when you have the lone piper up on the castle wall with one spotlight just right on him.
Yes,
and I don't quite get it, but all of the Scottish people around me are really moved by it. And
absolutely.
It's just there's sort of a contagious emotion that sweeps the audience.
Absolutely.
I think it pulls at your heartstrings, the sound of the pipes. That's why they were used for funerals. They were used for stirring the clans up and also for calming them down and for a requiem.
But when you hear that pipe Scottish people, what does it do for you?
Goosebumps. The hair on the back of the neck, goosebumps.
Why?
It's everything. It's your whole being. It's in your genes. It's just one of the situations. I am probably the luckiest person in the world. I can claim to have seen every tattoo performance since its conception.
When?
My father took me and I stood on the top of the Camera Obscura in the 50s. And I have seen every tattoo performance since.
So it's an annual event since the 50s?
Annual event.
1949.
Since 1949.
Anne's just said it is the biggest cultural event now in the world, which is...
It's really worth seeing if you're in Britain in August.
Yep.
Watch it on TV even. Trish in Okinawa, Japan emailed us and says she's returning to Edinburgh with her husband and she wants to know about any romantic attractions that they should be sure to check out.
Well, I,
I think I'll let Anne, being a lady, go first, and then I'll come in with whatever the male idea is.
Okay, the female approach.
I immediately think about this. Not many people know about this, but there's a suite of rooms called the Inner Sanctum above a famous restaurant called The Witchery, right next to the castle. And I used it once for a film crew when they were filming Sherlock Holmes. It's lavishly done with antiques. It's extremely romantic, but you'd need to have a healthy budget to stay there. He's got another suite of rooms as well, but it would come under the witchery near the castle if you wanted to get in touch with them. And also the same company, the same chap called James Thompson, bought Prestonfield House, which is an old manor house just outside. It was just outside the city. It's now incorporated into the city. And he's got amazing style, and he's redesigned this manor house. And there's a restaurant there called Rhubarb, which is really worth visiting, and it would be great for a romantic dinner.
I ate there with my film crew. It wasn't romantic, but I can see how it could be romantic. And that's the Prestonfield House.
Prestonfield House.
And it's outside
Peacocks
of town,
on the
but
lawn.
Very close to the town. I mean, you're surrounded by greenery and farmland and animals.
Arthur's Seat.
That's where they have one of the cheesy Scottish folk shows, so I wouldn't get sucked into that personally. But the hotel and even just the restaurant are a wonderful experience. Prestonfield House.
I think the other side, the more romantic side away from the hotels, which Anne rightly mentioned in the restaurant, and the connection with Rhubarb, actual fact, is that one of the families brought the seeds for rhubarb back from the part of the world where this lady comes from. But anyway, one of my suggestions would be for a romantic visit, and Japanese gentlemen like wearing a Scottish kilt, and ladies very much like their Japanese man in a kilt. And down the Royal Mile, there is a close called Dunbar's Close. And they have a copy of a 17th century town garden there. Now, the mentality behind the town garden is a courtship. You would start a courtship in one part of it. And if that courtship and that relationship went further, you go to another part in the garden. And if it went further and you had a wedding and children, there was another part of the garden. So I think Dunbar's Close, a formal recreated town garden, would be another must visit. And also,
wear a kilt.
So for Trish in Okinawa, you think she would enjoy taking her lover to Dunbar's Close?
Absolutely.
Dunbar's Close, where you have a progression of little town gardens that get more and more romantic.
Aye.
And you can rent a kilt.
Yes.
Actually, Ken rented me a kilt when we were there filming our TV show. And it's the equivalent of where high school kids would go to rent tuxedos in my town. But I really enjoyed being fitted into a kilt and wearing that thing. And that's an interesting idea to spice up and spiff up your Edinburgh experience.
Yeah.
I'm talking with Ken Hanley and Anne Doig, two friends of mine who are tour guides and travel experts from Edinburgh. I want to finish things off by just taking our listeners to the top of Arthur's Seat. And we're at a volcanic mountain. It's a small mountain. It's easy to hike up in 45 minutes or something like that. And you get this very exciting king of the mountain feeling. And around you stretches Edinburgh and the countryside. Take me up there, Anne, and then Ken, and tell me what the view means to you.
Well, the view means to me, well, you're looking down to the coast, and I love the coast, coastal villages, the seafaring tradition. You're looking east and south down the coast. If you're looking north, you're looking up to the castle. You see there are hundreds of church spires in Edinburgh, that reminding you of all the religious turmoils, but used by the festival nowadays, all the churches. This massive castle on a volcanic core, and then beyond that, the regular beautiful squares and designed neoclassical new town. And then again, you're seeing more water to the north, the Firth of Forth, that used to be a fantastic commercial link with Northern Europe, and the hills of Fife and St Andrews. So it means a lot being up there. And you're also in the centre of this amazing architecture. You're in the wilderness. You're in a wild place, a high place.
What a grand...
And you can get there in 45 minutes.
A grand spot, Ken.
Yeah. Well, I've got to echo these sentiments. But for a different slant on it, for me, I stand there in wonder and look at what Mother Nature gave us. And I look at the castle, this extinct volcanic plaque. And I see the back of the lava flow running, which the experts call the classic crag and tail formation, the birth of a nation, the birth of a country. And it's all viewed from the top of Arthur's Seat. You look over the body of water and you look at the the home of Christianity for us, in a sense, to St Andrews. You look at that whole Fife coastal area, and you're looking north up into the Highlands, you're looking west, you're looking south to the border country. It's an absolute pinnacle to observe and to take in the culture of a nation from one viewpoint, which is absolutely just stunning.
One viewpoint that is emblematic of what Edinburgh is, I think, to Scotland.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure there's that.
Ken, can you wrap things up with some beautiful example of your language?
I think it would be appropriate for us at this moment in time to finish with a wee touchy Robbie Burns.
Robert Burns.
And Robbie was a man of the people, a commoner like myself, a non-intellect, but someone who had a passion for his country. And he might have said something like, "Well, fair for the honest sonsy face, the great chieftain o' the Purn race, aboon them all, attack your place, but pange, thrive and fear them. But where they were they owe a grace, or there's long as it ear them. But see this rustic labour dict, we cut ye up, we bony sicked. What a sicked, warum reekin." And Burns is infusing about his country.
Translate
about
that
his
for
passion.
Me. I mean, you can say that in an understandable English for me, yeah. Now, if you can.
Well, basically, he's doing, and the other example is in Scots language, would be some hae meat and can eat, and some hae meat that want it. And we hae meat and we can eat, and say the Lord be thank it. So, in other words, Burns is doing this incredible, in depth thank you for his country, for his nation, for the food. And in the simplistic way is the other one in English that I said to you as well.
And to be proud of your Scottishness.
Well, that goes without saying.
That's right. Anne Doig and Ken Hanley, thank you very much for sharing the wonders of your city with us.
Thank you, Rick.
Pleasure and slange.
Rick Steves teaches smart travel to Great Britain, Ireland and beyond. On Rick's website, you'll find an archive of interviews from his radio show, free audio tours, a monthly travel newsletter, and a world of information to help you turn your travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. To prepare for your next adventure in Great Britain or Ireland, begin your trip at ricksteves.com.